Hi, I'm Hannah Baba, host of Cross Currents. Just a few times a year, we ask for your support, and now is the time to do that. It's our spring membership campaign, and your donation today supports this program and all the others you hear on this station. So if you like what you hear, make a contribution. Go to klw.org and click donate. Thanks.
KALW.
You go to the recall rallies and, you know, you see a lot of people who, you know, Alameda County residents who are upset with the DA's office for a variety of reasons.
A coalition to recall Alameda County District Attorney Pamela Price has gathered more than 123,000 signatures.
You know, had they been on their own without the financial backing of certain individuals, they may not have been able to gather enough signatures in time.
A conversation with Oakland Side's Darwin Bond-Graham. Then a children's book author reimagines Rapunzel with a twist.
So I made up and, you know, told my friends, I said, the only way somebody gets me down the tower has to be delicious food.
Plus a reading from our series, Bay Poets. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. First, we'll start with the latest in the effort to recall the Alameda County District Attorney. The Recall Pamela Price Coalition submitted petitions to the county registrar containing more than 123,000 signatures. That's about 50,000 more than required. If enough of those signatures are certified, the county will order a special recall election sometime this year. KALW's Sunni Khalid spoke with Darwin Bond-Graham, news editor at the Oakland Side, about the recall campaign, who's supporting it, and who's opposing it.
You've been tracking this recall effort. How serious is this? Were you surprised that they came up with the number of signatures?
Not surprised at all that pro-recall campaign has come up with, well, they say they've come up with, right, more than 100,000 something signatures. They spent, it looks like, upwards of $2 million mostly to employ a professional signature gathering company to, you know, go in front of like Safeways and Trader Joe's and, you know, just go around town and set up tables in front of places like farmers markets and things like that and gather these signatures. They were doing it for many months. And, you know, when you spend that much money and employ a bunch of professional signature gatherers, it's really only a matter of time before you can get something like this on the ballot. I mean, obviously, if it wasn't in a constituency that wanted to sign the petition, it would have taken a lot longer and been more difficult. But it seems like there was a constituency there who like wants to sign the petition. But, you know, they had to pay quite a bit of money to accomplish this.
Well, I talked to Brenda Grisham, who has made common cause with some of the tech folks who came up with a lot of that $2 million. And she told me that it was a grassroots movement. She deflected questions that it was part of some right-wing extremist conspiracy, which some of her supporters have said. Is this a grassroots campaign that has sort of been taken over by larger moneyed interests? What is it?
In reporting on it and watching the campaign, I think the answer is sort of both. You know, the activists who are really propelling the campaign and speaking to the media and organizing rallies, the public faces of the campaign, these are longtime members of the Oakland community, right? Brenda Grisham, Carl Chan. Carl Chan was the president of the Oakland Chinatown Chamber of Commerce, longtime advocate for Oakland Chinatown. And yeah, they're very well known in Oakland. They've been here for many decades. And, you know, you go to the recall rallies and, you know, you see a lot of people who, you know, Alameda County residents who are upset with the DA's office for a variety of reasons. You know, had they been on their own without the financial backing of certain individuals, they may not have been able to gather enough signatures in time. Again, the nature of like these recalls is you've got to gather a bunch of voter signatures within a pretty short time frame. So what happened here is it looks like there's some pretty wealthy individuals and companies that are interested in the recall also. And so they set up a campaign committee and put quite a bit of money into it to pay for most of the signature gathering. I think it's bull.
Didn't they basically outspend Pam Price, her supporters, like 20 to 1?
the amount of money they raised and spent to gather the signatures so far, it's like over $2 million. Pam Price, to defend herself against the recall, she's raised far less than that. I think it's worth pointing out, though, the recall campaign, it hasn't made it onto the ballot yet, right? So the signatures have to be verified. Once it makes it onto the ballot, that's really the stage at which Pamela Price has more of an incentive to campaign against the recall. When it's just in a signature gathering phase, there's not a lot that the incumbent DA can do to counter that. They're going to gather signatures no matter what. But once it's on the ballot, you're going to see a flurry of spending in support and opposed to the recall. So I would expect to see Price trying to raise a lot more money in a month or two if the recall measure actually gets onto the ballot.
Brenda Grisham told me that it'll take 10 days for the registrar to certify whether there will be a recall election or not. And she said it'd be a special election within 30 days as opposed to waiting for November. What do you know about that?
I'm a little confused. I'm just going to admit that because Alameda County voters just passed Measure B, which rewrites the rules for how to recall a public official in the county. So Alameda County is like one of, if not the only counties in California that had its own unique recall rules. They didn't conform to the rules that the state uses and most of the other counties use to recall a public official. And so the Board of Supervisors, you know, put a measure on the ballot saying, hey, we want to rewrite the way that you recall public officials here. So voters just passed that. And that changes the rules. So in some ways, maybe it's to the benefit of the recall campaign. So instead of just 10 days for the registrar to do this crucial work of verifying signatures, they'll have 30 days, perhaps even longer. There's some ways in which, you know, maybe this change could counter the recall campaign. It essentially increases the number of signatures they would need by like maybe about 20,000 additional signatures because it changes the formula, what percent of registered voters or people who voted in the last election you need signatures from. And it would also change the time frame under which a special election would occur, could push it out to, you know, the November general election, which, you know, could see higher turnout of Price supporters than say like a special election. Special elections tend to have very low voter turnout. So it tends to be more white voters and upper income voters who might be a little more conservative in their views. The confusing thing here is, do these changes take effect like now? Do they impact the recall campaign? That's what's not clear to me. You know, maybe other people out there like actually know the answer to this. Yeah, I would love to know if this actually changes what has to happen going forward.
Some people have referred to the new DA as mercurial or polarizing. She's only been DA for 14 months. How has she become such a polarizing figure that would be the target of a recall campaign?
The recall proponents have zeroed in on what they view as Pamela Price's leniency toward people who commit crimes. And they've made really big deals around particular cases where they feel like that the criminal defendants weren't facing enough time in prison if they were convicted. They've pointed to cases where they feel like charges were dismissed for the wrong reasons. Certain plea deals were accepted that didn't result in someone going to prison long enough. They've objected to Price's policies of not charging juveniles as adults. That's something where that Price has been really steadfast about. I think her own biography was, you know, she was someone who came up when she grew up, she was a foster youth. So she says she sort of experienced these things where you're not really given a chance to have a full life. And so she's worried about a lot of young people in Alameda County, particularly youth of color who make mistakes when they're children. And she doesn't want to see them locked up for lengthy prison sentences that could transform their lives into just being behind bars most of their lives. So her opponents view all this stuff as being too lenient. And in their view of the world, it seems when you don't have harsh penalties for people who commit crimes, then you're encouraging more criminal activity. They've blamed the DA for increases in robberies, shootings, homicides, burglaries, things like that. If you look at the crime stats in Alameda County, shootings, homicides, other crimes, they were already increasing before Price came into office. But it is true that there has been an enormous spike in certain categories of like burglaries, like auto burglary, car thefts, things like that, while Price has been in office. Whether that's her fault, whether that's the result of her policies or not, I don't think anyone's done the research and really looked at that in a dispassionate way to like prove that or not. We know crime goes up and down over time. It's hard to explain why. This is a big clash of philosophies around criminal justice. Price is a reformer. She believes that you can transform people's lives, change people, that you don't need to rely on police and prisons to make a safer society. On the other side, there are people who just fundamentally disagree with what Price is trying to do with the justice system. And they want to bring back a DA who's like the more traditional Alameda County DA, sort of like Nancy O'Malley and the other predecessors in that office who were much more willing to just send people to prison for long periods of time.
That was Darwin Von Graham, news editor at The Oakland Side, speaking with KLW news editor Sunni Khalid. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. Rapunzel and the Stinky Tofu is a Rapunzel-like story that takes place in China. But in this tale, it's going to take more than a handsome prince to convince the princess to leave the tower. He needs to bring a yummy dish with him, too. Award-winning writer Yingcheng Compostine is based in the East Bay. She spoke with KLW's Janae Darden about the book and how growing up during the Chinese Cultural Revolution inspired her work.
Ying, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I've been wanting to talk to you for a while. So, and I know I took one of your classes some years ago, so it's good to see you again. But before we talk about your book, I noticed something in your work, which is it revolves around food. And I love food. I'm a foodie. I know you are too. I've seen when you cook for your family and you post it online on social media. So I see some of the delicious looking dishes that you create. Why do you like to pair food with your books, with your stories?
Well, I have two passions, is food and literature. I think that has a lot to do with my childhood. Growing up in China during the Cultural Revolution, food was rationed. So I feel like I never got enough to eat. So I was always hungry. And so that's what, like, even today, you know, food is on my mind all the time. I love to eat. So to get good food, I just thought after I came to the state and went to graduate school in CU Boulder, there was not really many good Chinese restaurants. So I have to learn to cook. So I developed a passion for cooking just because I love to eat. And books, because the Western book were burned. So I was really hungry for good literature. So that's why, you know, later on, I just feel like I'm in heaven when I came to this country. I can go into the library to get all kinds, read any books I want.
You know, I'm listening to you talk about growing up and not having access to food and not having access to books and stories. And I'm thinking about just how sometimes we take things for granted. You were just saying how the library was such a special place for you, you know, when you first came here.
Yeah, you know, first time I walked in the library, I checked out a book at the University of Boulder. And the librarian said, you can keep the book for 6 months. I thought, what? 6 months? That's just unbelievable. You know, first in China, besides the propaganda book, during my childhood, every other book was missing pages and it was forbidden. Even later on, when the book, you know, after the Cultural Revolution, we were able to get a couple books, was always like, you got to return in a week.
So when you were younger, did you, because you like stories, clearly, and you're good at telling them. When you were younger, when you were with your friends, did you secretly tell stories? Did you secretly create stories?
You know, with my friend, at that time, you tell who is your best friend. It's not who is going to invite you to their birthday party, because we never really had a birthday party. And it's who will lend you the forbidden book. And you know, when the government, if they find out you're reading a forbidden book, the whole family could be in trouble. So you only lend those books to your most trustworthy friend. So whenever I get a copy of those books, of, you know, always missing pages, I love fairy tale, folktale. That's what inspired me to write a lot of the folktale retelling, including my new book. And so when I read Rapunzel, and that was without ending, the missing page, somebody tore it apart. So I just thought, I made up my own ending. And so as my friends, everybody was just have their own fantasy how this girl is going to come down the tower. So some of my friends would say, oh, it would be have to be some handsome prince. And someone else said it would be, you know, beautiful clothes. I love the clothes. You know, at that time, we only allowed to wear a mouse uniform. I love the clothes, but then I love the food even more than the beautiful clothes. So I made up the ending, you know, told my friends. I said, the only way somebody get me down the tower has to be delicious food.
And just to remind everybody, the name of your book is Rapunzel and the Stinky Tofu.
Yes.
What is stinky tofu? And that's a real thing.
It is a real thing. Is the tofu fermented in like a fish sauce or maybe vegetable broth? It's kind of how the process, a little bit similar like how you make the cheese. It is very stinky, but the tofu, stinky tofu, is stinky, but if you can get past the smell, it's delicious.
First of all, I like Puzel because from what I read, Ra Puzel. So Ra is her family name, and then Puzel is her would be her first name, right? That's what I read. Okay, so Puzel the princess, I like her because I like to eat. So, and I like a man that can cook. So I understand why she waited for a prince. That's what brought her down, was a man that could cook. So I'm with Puzel on that. I like how you reimagined the story, and I know it was influenced by your own childhood, and you were thinking the only way to, you know, for me to come down the tower was somebody have to have some really good food there. But we're noticing more and more now, I think it's even becoming normal, how the way people are reimagining fairy tales is not so much as the female characters just waiting to be rescued, waiting for a prince. You see more of these women having their own identity, having their own autonomy. So can you talk about that kind of just how, I guess you as a writer, you know, making empowering female characters in fairy tales?
Yeah. You know, I have to tell you a story. A couple of years ago, I gave a talk at the Chinatown in New York, at a school inside Chinatown. During my talk, all the girls, everybody was very quiet. I keep asking, do you have any questions? They just stared at me. Nobody said anything. So I thought, oh, they do not like what I have to say. But at the minute after I finished my talk, all the girls just came, surrounded me. And a couple of girls touched my sleeves and touched my hair. And I said, do you guys have any questions? Finally, one girl was very shiny. She said, what can we do to be like you? And I thought for a while. I said, you mean you want to be a writer? She said, no, we want to be just like you. And then I thought for a while. I said, well, the first thing is speak your mind and don't be afraid. You know, raise your hands when you have something to say. So that one, you know, kind of stayed with me. Since then, I thought, if I'm going to write story for young readers, I really want to portray strong female character. And also, I want to change the perception that Asians are weak. We're not weak. We're very strong. We're smart. And we stand for ourselves. You know, just if, you know, more people, more especially the younger generation, need to get this message.
One of the things I've noticed about you is that you are so full of life. Like when I see you, you're just you're a small person, but you have such a big presence and just a big smile and just big energy. And I can tell you love what you do. And I get this feeling that you love life. And I just want to know, where does that come from?
Thank you, dear. Well, I feel like I never had a childhood. You know, I lived through 10 years of cultural revolution. During that time, I never got a chance to wear the colorful clothes. I never get the time to read the books I really want to read and not be afraid being caught. and I never really have enough to do all the fun things I want to do. So now I feel like I'm revisiting my childhood a lot of the time. I just remember I went to Fairyland, did a book event with them. Afterwards, I dragged my husband. I said, let's go to ride a train. Let's go to do everything. And while we get on the train, it was so funny. The person standing there, he said, where are your kids? Because every other people are there, the kids and the parents.
Right.
I love it. And I said, we have no kids. I'm the kids. So we rode that train twice around the park. And I just, you know, I just feel so happy.
That was author Ying Chang Compestin, author of the children's book Rapunzel and the Stinky Tofu. She spoke with KALW's Janae Darden. That interview was co-produced by Porfirio Rangel. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. This month, KALW's series Bay Poets is honoring women's history by featuring the work of local women poets. Here's Dr. Naomi Helena Quiñones reading us her poem, Sometime the Moon.
Sometimes the moon tells us stories, but we don't hear them. Sometimes the moon divulges her secrets to the night, but we don't listen. Sometimes the moon waits in shadow to pour her tales into our dreams, but we ignore them. We have forgotten the language of stars and the moon's ancient tales about death and dying and remembrance. The old stories about how wounds are made and healed, and how the essence of our unruly life does not vanish at daybreak. Obscurity exiles the divine feminine, a collective, creative, cobalt power of consciousness to a sun-struck, broken world, a mania of manipulated masculinities, and endless destructions in the stark light of day.
That was Dr. Naomi Helena Quiñones reading her poem, Sometime the Moon. You can find her poem and other works by local poets at kalw.org/baypoets. For Cross Currents, I'm Henat Baba.